Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rebecca Wilse of the Center for Media and Democracy, who talks about her recent report that investigates the State Policy Network, a right-wing think tank that promotes the corporate agenda in state government. Hope Metcalf of Yale University Law School, who examines the practice of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, which the U.N. has concluded amounts to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. And Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press, who assesses the policy views of newly appointed FCC Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Twenty years after the demise of South Africa's racist apartheid regime, access to land is still a hot topic. For years, the ruling African National Congress has pushed for land reform, but progress has remained slow as the vast majority of commercial farms remains in the hands of white farmers. For decades under apartheid, blacks were stripped of land rights under the 1913 Natives Land Act. Nelson Mandela and the new ANC government in 1994 promised dramatic reform with the goal of putting 30% of commercial farmland into the hands of blacks. But by 2012, only 10% of commercial lots were farmed by black families. In the run-up to South Africa's 2014 election, the ANC is ramping up its agenda on land reform. The government wants to speed up the transfer of land and reopen land claims by thousands of blacks who were rejected previously. Still, the ANC is facing criticism that the new reform effort will not benefit poor black subsistence farmers, but instead favor a new generation of elite, high-tech commercial farmers. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, half the Christian population of that war-torn nation has fled violence, intimidation, and death threats. Over the last decade, there have been over 60 attacks on Iraqi churches. Today's violence against Christians is only the most recent wave of repression targeting the minority religious group in the Middle East. During the era of the Mamluk Sultanate in Egypt from 1250 to 1517, Christians faced intense discrimination and persecution. During the subsequent Ottoman Empire, Christians were given more autonomy and were able to worship openly until the 1915 genocide in Armenia. Christians in Syria fear a new religious bloodbath as the three-year civil war grinds on and Islamist groups dominate opposition forces challenging the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Christian-owned businesses are increasingly being targeted. The July 2013 military coup against democratically elected Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi led to a massive backlash against Coptic Christians by some Islamist groups. The intensity of the anti-Coptic violence offended Sheikh Ali Goma, the former Grand Mufti of Egypt, one of Islam's most respected jurists, who blasted attacks on Christians as a violation of Islamic law. Socialist college professor Kashama Sawant's election to the Seattle City Council is a minor milestone for left-wing political parties in the U.S. Her victory raised expectations that a self-declared socialist could win in cities with strong progressive traditions. This fall, a number of socialist candidates ran competitive races in Seattle, Minneapolis, and Boston. Sawant beat a longtime Democratic incumbent by 1,000 votes. In Minneapolis, socialist Ty Moore narrowly lost a city council race where well-known liberal Democrats like Representative Keith Ellison and U.S. Senator Al Franken campaigned for her opponent, Alondra Kano. Sawant and Moore have ties to Socialist Alternative, a party that was founded in Britain in the 1980s to challenge the centrist Labour Party under Tony Blair. Activists in the U.S. later revived the U.S. Labor Party, which has since shut down, to challenge the Democratic Party establishment. The news magazine In These Times reports Socialist Alternative changed gears in 2013 when the party decided to run in several select races where they had a possibility of victory. Socialist Alternative candidates won strong backing from housing, labor, and immigrant rights activists. Sawant won the endorsement of four Seattle area local labor unions. In Minneapolis, Javier Murillo, president of the SEIU Local 26, saw the election as an opportunity to push City Hall to the left. Murillo insisted progressive governance needs left flanks. The local's goal is always to move the ball forward as far as we can on progressive issues. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
When researchers at the Center for Media and Democracy and investigative reporters scratch beneath the surface of legislative campaigns in many states pushing stand-your-ground gun laws, measures to make it more difficult for Democratic Party constituency groups to vote, and other conservative initiatives, they've found ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC brings together state legislators and corporations, which launch coordinated efforts to rewrite state laws by producing model bills that are then proposed, debated, and voted on in state capitals around the U.S. Since the murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida, and widespread controversy focusing on ALEC-sponsored voter suppression legislation, ALEC has lost both corporate members and donors. Now, a new investigation launched by the Center for Media and Democracy has exposed ALEC's under-the-radar partner in their state legislative campaigns. The State Policy Network, or SPN, founded in 1992, is funded by many of the same right-wing foundations, corporations, and wealthy donors, including the billionaire Koch brothers, who shower money on ALEC. While appearing to be a group of like-minded but independent think tanks, SPN produces reports, presents statistics, and drafts talking points in support of right-wing legislation under cover of what appears to be a neutral, nonpartisan, nonprofit charitable organization. Your reporter spoke with Rebecca Wills, a reporter and researcher with the Center for Media and Democracy, who talks about her recent report titled Exposed, The State Policy Network, the powerful right-wing network helping to hijack state politics and government.
What it is a web of, at this point, 64 state affiliates in every single state in the country that are major drivers of the ALEC-backed corporate agenda in state houses nationwide. They have deep ties to the Koch brothers in many cases and the national right-wing network of funders at large. Some of them seem to be skirting tax laws while they actually orchestrate extensive lobbying and political operations to peddle their legislative agenda to state legislators. And all the while, they report little or no lobbying activities.
If you could sum up their agenda, what are their primary issues that they push, and what is it they do towards that end?
Well, as you might expect, because as we uncovered, they have quite a bit of corporate funding. They really push a corporate-backed agenda, and that runs from undermining workers' rights by pushing so-called right-to-work laws in states and so-called paycheck protection, to undermining environmental protections and regulations, to trying to tear down public education and replace it with a for-profit model there as well as in really every sector. It works very closely with groups like Americans for Prosperity, as well as ALEC. And so the things we might say about those groups' agendas, we can say to a large extent about the SPN agenda.
Now, maybe you could give us some examples of some of the specific legislation or public policy initiatives that they've started up with.
Well, as I said, right to work, so-called right to work, is one of the major policy points that they've worked on. In Michigan, where, of course, they passed right to work quite recently, the Mackinac Center is the SPN affiliate there in the state. And that group has been working more or less since its founding to turn Michigan into a right-to-work state. In fact, it won an award from SPN, its top award at its most recent annual meeting, for getting that legislation passed in Michigan. And yet, Mackinac Center has not reported any lobbying to the IRS for the past several years, over the course of which it's done extensive work towards getting that bill passed into law. Also, for-profit online education. There have been a raft of these types of bills coming out of ALEC, some of which are introduced by some SPN member groups, many of which are then taken back to the states by the ALEC legislators, but also pushed back in their home states by these SPN affiliates. So there's several of them. But they, what ends up happening is that these for-profit online education companies like K-12 Inc., which is the biggest one, and Connections Academy, get a major boost because all of a sudden these laws are passed and they're allowed into more and more states across the country, which is a major benefit for their bottom line. And K-12 Inc. is one of the national web group SPN's funders.
Tell us about specifically who we know funds the work of the State Policy Network.
Yeah, so that was one of the major discoveries we made in this report. You know, in the past, we've been able to uncover a little bit about the foundation donors to the State Policy Network as a whole. As you know, all of these groups, they're registered as 501c3 nonprofits, and so they don't have to disclose their donors. But we were unable to discover a list of donors to, again, the national group, State Policy Network, for 2010. And some of the groups on that list are what you'd expect. So what's been called the right-wing ATM Donors Trust was on there, giving in between $250,000 and $600,000. But also BMO Harris Bank, GlaxoSmithKline, AT&T, Microsoft, Verizon, Kraft Foods, the tobacco companies, Philip Morris, Altria, and Reynolds American. And then more recently in 2013, some companies and nonprofits that sponsored the recent SPN annual meeting included some newer companies to SPN's funding list, like Facebook and the e-cigarette company Enjoy. Comcast did as well. Americans for Tax Reform, which is an affiliated group, and there's a whole list of sort of affiliated nonprofits that also funded and sponsored SPN's latest meeting.
Rebecca, maybe talk a little bit more about the relationship between the State Policy Network and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is infamous as a result of previous work and research done by the Center for Media and Democracy for promoting anti-labor legislation, voter suppression legislation, stand-your-ground gun laws, and a whole slew of other things that I think most Americans find themselves opposed to.
One of the ways that was sort of most obvious was that all of these SPN affiliates take this ALEC legislation and they push it in their home states. And we did a review of their websites and we found that all of them then do that. But in addition, and you know, more strikingly, we found that at least 35 of SPN's current affiliates have more direct ties to ALEC. So they sit on the task forces. They introduce or in the past have introduced quote-unquote model legislation. And they have really direct ties via those task forces to those legislators.
That was Rebecca Wills, a reporter and researcher with the Center for Media and Democracy. Find a link to her report titled Exposed, The State Policy Network, the powerful right-wing network helping to hijack state politics and government, on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Prison solitary confinement is considered a form of torture and prohibited under the Geneva Conventions, which the U.S. initiated and has signed on to. Yet the U.S. has employed various degrees of segregation in prisons, both at Guantanamo Bay and inside America's prison system. The National Religious Campaign Against Torture has taken up this issue, and in mid-December, the Washington, D.C.-based organization held a public forum in New Haven, Connecticut, presenting an update on the treatment of the prisoners remaining at Guantanamo. Hope Metcalf, another speaker at the event, is director of the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Program at Yale University Law School and a lecturer there. Metcalf has spent years researching the effects of solitary confinement and visited prisons, spoken with correctional officers, wardens, inmates, and their family members to learn more about the practice. In testimony before a U.S. Senate subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights in June 2012, Metcalf and her colleague Judith Resnick, Arthur Lyman Professor of Law, cited the following conclusion made by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment in a 2011 report. The Special Rapporteur stated, quote, 15 days is the maximum period prisoners can spend in solitary confinement without suffering permanent mental harm, considering the severe mental pain or suffering solitary confinement may cause when used as a punishment. It can amount to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Here in an excerpt of Metcalf's talk in New Haven, She describes her years of working on the issue of solitary confinement and the conclusions she's drawn about the practice.
I wanted to just take a moment to think about what it is when we talk about solitary confinement. So many times in the media, the way it's described is that it's a sort of total sensory deprivation. That does happen, but that total sensory deprivation is in fewer prisons. That is not, I would say, actually the full 80,000 people that we hear about when we talk about who's in, quote, solitary. It is a horrible, horrible thing, but it is relatively rare. However, equally damaging and horrible is something that I think might be better termed something like total control and total submission. You might or might not have a cellmate of your own choosing. You might or might not be able to communicate with the person across the wall because people are creative and they have urges to be in contact with each other. Despite the fact that you might be able to communicate a little bit, and despite the fact that you may, in fact, have access to a radio or to books, it is not the total sensory deprivation that we might think. It is nonetheless one of the harshest environments that you could devise for a human being, and it is characterized not so much by its isolation, but by its hostility and by the systematic efforts to break you down and to control every single aspect of your life. Why does this exist, and why is it so pervasive? There is a similar doctrine that lays at the foundation of the supermax boom of the mid-90s as to what we then saw in its most perverse, extreme version post-9/11. And that is what was called in military documents, quote, learned helplessness. So the point of these interrogations, you know, we hear about the waterboarding, but one of the most effective means of torture was, in fact, sensory deprivation, and that is because you would render the prisoner totally dependent and you would psychologically debilitate them. Supermax institutions likewise were designed to control every aspect of the prisoner, and in the words of one corrections officer with whom I've spoken, his understanding and what he was taught was that the purpose of the institution was to break them down because they are causing problems. Perhaps they've been violent, perhaps they've just been obstreperous, or somehow causing trouble in the prison system. As a prisoner, you're in your cell for every hour of the week, except for 3 times when you get to shower, 5 times when you're taken out to an exercise cage. You'd be in an exercise cage by yourself. You may be in the cell by yourself or with somebody not of your choosing, who you may fear, and you might be terrified, and you may very well prefer to be by yourself. All of your food, medicine, reading materials comes through the steel trap at the bottom of the door. You're under constant surveillance. There are checks of your cell every 15 minutes, including at night when a flashlight will shine in and wake you up. You may experience friendships with other prisoners. You may experience friendships with other corrections officers. You may also experience serious harassment by other prisoners or serious harassment by other corrections officers, and you will have nowhere to go. Retreat is not an option because you are there and you are literally hostage to whomever might be trying to make your life miserable. The very bad news is that institutions shape people. But the very good news is that if we change the institution, we change the people. So based on my experience in Connecticut and what we've been able to do with in cooperation with the department and other advocates, and not to mention the incredible courage of our clients, I have a few observations. The first is that to make lasting change, we cannot wish away the fact that prisons can be dangerous places. We have to acknowledge the very real challenges that corrections officers face in their daily lives, as well as prisoners. Prisons must be safe for all people who live and work there. We need more and less isolating forms of separation. So the idea that people should be separated and treated in accordance with their needs, there may be people who are violent and who are also mentally ill, and they need to be dealt with, but dealt with humanely and in a way that actually works.
That was Hope Metcalf, director of the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Program at Yale University Law School. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on Metcalf's research on solitary confinement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With President Obama's appointment of new FCC Commissioner Tom Wheeler and the Senate's unanimous confirmation of his nomination to become the agency's chairman on October 29th, the era of outgoing FCC chair Julius Genachowski came to a close. Genachowski had been criticized by media reform groups for cheerleading many communications industry actions, often to the detriment of consumers. Although President Obama campaigned for the White House in 2008, pledging to strengthen net neutrality protections for Internet users, Genachowski often caved into pressure from telecom giants like AT&T and Comcast, rejecting tough regulations, supporting instead weaker rules with corporate-friendly loopholes. Genachowski had also been criticized during his five-year term for his lack of leadership in advocating any meaningful action on limiting the consolidation of media ownership and little or no support for policies favoring media diversity, opening doors for women and communities of color to compete for broadcast licenses. Now, with Tom Wheeler's appointment to head the FCC, there was speculation about where the former lobbyists for the cable TV and cell phone industry would take the regulatory agency in the coming years. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press. Here he discusses his group's ongoing work advocating for net neutrality and an assessment of positions taken by the newly confirmed FCC chair, Tom Wheeler.
Tom Wheeler's an interesting guy because he's been around town for a long time. And we were very skeptical about his nomination at Free Press, largely because we didn't think enough questions were being asked about his background. And that background includes a stint as the top lobbyist for the cable industry back in the 70s and 80s. And then he did another stint as the top lobbyist for the cell phone industry in the 90s and early 2000s. And yet here he was, Barack Obama's choice to be the head of the FCC. He's also a guy who raised a lot of money for the president. It's been interesting to see him in the first couple of weeks on the job, because despite a lot of those concerns, and I won't say that those concerns have gone away about what he's going to do and his very corporate orientation, he has been saying a lot of the right things. He's been talking about the importance of competition. He's been talking about the importance of the FCC as a regulatory body. He's not shying away from that responsibility at the Federal Communications Commission. As always, the question is going to be whether the results match the rhetoric. I did have a chance to sit down with Mr. Wheeler a couple weeks ago. He met with a bunch of leaders of public interest groups in Washington. He clearly demonstrated that he's a savvy politician, which is not something to be underestimated in this job. And I think The real questions are going to come with a number of these big issues that are about to land on Mr. Wheeler's plate. Net neutrality, there's a big court case coming down, and the results of that decision are really going to question whether the Federal Communications Commission can offer any protection to Internet users. There's a whole series of proceedings involving auctioning off of the airwaves and the transition of our phone networks from the old copper ones to fiber optic networks, and whether we're still going to have consumer protections there. There's a strong corporate effort to try to take away any kind of oversight authority or meaningful authority from the FCC. Tom Wheeler's going to have to deal with that. We've got media consolidation going on under the FCC's nose. So there's going to be no shortage of challenges. Mr. Wheeler's predecessor left a big mess for him to deal with. And, you know, we're going to have to see. I think the key is for the public to keep the pressure on, especially here in these early days. I think Mr. Wheeler has a need to demonstrate, perhaps, that he's not there to simply serve the interests of corporate America. And I think we'll know pretty soon whether that's really true.
Craig, maybe just say a word about a letter that you were quite hopeful about. It was a letter from U.S. Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia to FCC Chair Wheeler regarding the need to enforce limits on media ownership, that by Senator Rockefeller's account, many of these companies are using ethically questionable tactics to avoid complying with those rules.
Yeah, that's right. And as we've probably talked about before, you know, we've witnessed, you know, so much runaway media consolidation, so much damage to our local media systems, you know, unaccountable out-of-town owners taking over, independent voices disappearing. And we're now looking at local television news, where fortunately at the FCC we've been able to hold off the kind of wholesale gutting of the rules they've been trying to do for years. You know, for the last 10 years, there hasn't been a change in media ownership rules because of public opposition and because of winning a few important court cases. But what's happened is that the companies feel that they found a loophole, and some of your listeners will be familiar with Sinclair Broadcasting, which, if they close all the deals they're working on now, will soon become the largest owner of television stations in the country in terms of numbers of television stations. And what Sinclair has done in a model that is now being copied by a lot of other companies is they've essentially set up a network of shell companies that allow them to evade FCC rules but still continue to control local television stations. So in many, many markets across the country, Sinclair now controls two and even three stations in a single market. And so you, what you find in these places now are, and Gannett is doing it now, Tribune, Nexstar, all the big companies are starting to do this, setting up former executives to basically hold a license while these companies run the station. And so now where you used to flip through the dial and see different kinds of news programming, you just see the same anchors repurposed with a new logo, sometimes not even that. You know, you might turn in on election night and you've got one set of coverage on three of four news stations in a given town. So this is obviously TV news, despite all its flaws, still the number one source of news for Americans, and they're clearly not getting the kind of information you're doing, not getting the full story. And companies like Sinclair have a very partisan right-wing agenda. These are the guys who refused to air Nightline a few years ago when it was airing the names of soldiers who'd been killed in Iraq. These are the guys who aired the John Kerry Swift Boat movie a couple days before the election. They're pushing a political agenda, and they're loading up on stations, especially in swing states. And so we've asked the FCC to look and say at what's obviously happening, which is that these guys are evading the rules. When they talk to the Securities and Exchange Commission, they treat these companies as subsidiaries. When they go to the FCC, they pretend they don't even know these guys. And we think it's time for the FCC to take action. These are clearly deals only designed to evade the FCC's rules. They're snubbing it in the FCC's face. They're now talking to their investors like this has been approved when it's never been the case. So we've been pushing the new chairman to really take action here, and we're very pleased that Senator Rockefeller spoke up and said, you know, don't look at changing any media ownership rules until you deal with this issue of what they call shared services agreements, what I would call covert media consolidation.
That was Greg Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press. Find more information on the group's campaigns for media democracy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.